Welcome to the Kansas Secretary of State's office. How may I help you?
Hi, I just moved here and I'd like to register to vote.
We're not accepting new voters.
I don't believe that.
Most people do. I guess you're today's I read the Constitution lunatic.
I know my rights.
I just bet you do. Okay, I'm going to need to see your documents. You need to show a birth certificate, driver's license, blue card, white card, dog tag mugshot, work permit, merchant marine credential, multipass, and a landing card.
I brought all that.
How about your Lydia Fairchild waiver?
What's that?
It proves you're not human-animal hybrid.
Oh, wait, I have that. I brought it.
What are the names of Pat Boone's daughters?
Cherry, Debbie, Linda Lee, and...
Everybody misses this one.
Laura Jean.
In your own words, tell me how you do the hokey pokey.
You put your right leg in, you put your right leg out, you put your right leg in, and you shake it all about. Do you want me to keep going?
Not really.
Am I a voter now?
Well, now there's a waiting period. We send all your documents to Russia, where a company called Stroganoff Business Tools cuts your card and mails it directly to you.
Russia?
They were the low bidder. Can I help who's next?
I have to say, this whole process seems intended to suppress voter participation.
Nice detective work, Matlock.
Technically, he was a lawyer.
Great. Maybe he'll handle your appeal. Can I help who's next?
Today on the show, the story behind the commission looking into voter fraud. Also, Jeff Fox. And now, the man who totally misunderstood what ICBM means, Colin McEnroe.
That was very embarrassing. And by the way, Jeff Fox is not involved in any way in voter suppression. I want to emphasize that. He's a guest on a completely different segment. The final segment of this show, in fact, will be Jeff Fox, a beloved meteorologist in the state who left. Now he's going to be back on the air, briefly anyway, or at least for the season. Although not the way meteorologists usually are. Anyway, we'll tell you all about that. We'll tell you also about activities in the Environmental Protection Agency, assuming they're even calling it that anymore. They maybe changed what the word P means in EPA, but we'll be talking about how Mr. Pruitt, the new head of the EPA, is advancing his agenda, maybe a little bit faster than many members of the Trump cabinet. We're going to begin with, as was suggested by that introduction, by the way, I always love Katie Tularsky as the unhelpful clerk. I mean, I write for her. I write for her to be that unhelpful clerk. Anyway, as suggested by that introduction, we're going to be talking about the whole issue of voter suppression, or as it is now known, at least in terms of one special body, the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. I guess we're talking about election integrity. And you may have been reading about the fact that they have made sweeping requests for information from the individual states, most of whom are very uncooperative. I mean, like 44 of whom, and there are only 50 after all, are very uncooperative. Joining us now is a reporter who knows probably about as much about this as anybody. He's written many of the signature articles on this subject. Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a reporting fellow at The Nation Institute and author of most recently Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. I would add that he also wrote a very chilling piece in the New York Times Magazine about Kris Kobach, the person that we are about to talk about. He is the vice chairman of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. He's also the Secretary of State in the aforementioned Kansas. So, Ari Berman, welcome to our show.
Hey, thank you, Colin. I like that bit of acting at the beginning.
Well, we specialize in that. First of all, what is the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity?
So it's a commission that was set up via executive order by Donald Trump. It is chaired by Vice President Mike Pence. The vice chair and the functional head of the commission is Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. And the purpose of the commission, according to the text of the executive order, is to examine what they call fraudulent or improper voting and fraudulent or improper registration, two issues that Kris Kobach has championed for many, many years, and that Donald Trump started tweeting a lot about when it looked like, A, he was going to lose the election, and then B, after he won the election but lost the popular vote. So really the whole reason we have this commission is because Donald Trump tweeted that millions of people voted illegally. A lot of people thought that wouldn't lead to anything, but here we are. We have a commission. They're apparently going to meet five times. Their first meeting is going to be July 19th. They're going to issue recommendations both at the state or the federal level and likely put out a report that will be made public.
Right. So going back to this, so Donald Trump at one point said 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. There isn't a scintilla of evidence that anything resembling that is even remotely true. And as you say, in some ways, it seemed as though maybe even to justify this act of vanity, a presidential advisory commission had to be formed. Although the other slightly more distrustful and paranoid way of looking at this is that this commission or something like it would have been formed no matter what, that in fact, you know, even for a time or in a time preceding the rise of Donald Trump, there has been a real interest in making the case that people vote illegally, that a lot of people vote illegally. And maybe you can comment on that and also just say, what is really known about how many people vote illegally?
Sure. So what's definitely been true is that well before Trump, many Republicans have been making wildly irresponsible claims about voter fraud and how likely it is that such fraud occurs, and that many, many states that are controlled by Republicans have, in response to all of these claims about voter fraud, put in place policies that make it harder to vote, whether that's strict voter ID laws or making voter registration more difficult or cutting back on early voting or disenfranchising ex-felons. Since the 2010 election, 22 states, nearly all of them controlled by Republicans, have put these new restrictions in place, and all of that predates Trump. Now, what I think is new is that this is happening now at the federal level. So it's one thing that when it happens in the states, it's another thing when the president of the United States does it and puts this commission in effect. And this request for voter data from all 50 states was really, to me, the precursor to this analysis the Trump administration was going to do, which was going to say all of these wildly irresponsible things about voter fraud and then say, oh, by the way, because all this fraud is occurring, we need to do X, Y, and Z. But the fact is that voter fraud is a very, very small problem in American elections. I'm not saying it never occurs, but it's quite rare. So, for example, if you look at there have been a number of different studies among a number of different years. But what we know about the 2016 election was one study by the Washington Post found 4 cases of voter fraud out of 135 million votes cast. Some analyses by different states have found maybe at most a few hundred people who voted illegally if you add it all up. We don't even know that because a lot of these are allegations. There's not actual convictions. In Kansas, Kris Kobach is one of the only secretaries of state. He's the only secretary of state, in fact, with the power to personally prosecute voter fraud cases. And he's convicted 9 people of illegally voting in Kansas out of 1.6 million registrants. Only one of them has been a non-citizen. The other 8 people, by and large, have been people who are 60 and older, retirees who own property in 2 states and don't realize that if you own property in Colorado, you can't vote in Kansas, which is illegal, but a mistake that sometimes people make every once in a while. So I would say that the claims about voter fraud that we're hearing from Donald Trump, from Kris Kobach, from many other people have been wildly, wildly overstated.
Right. I got on the Secretary of State's website in Kansas today and noticed the same thing, that here is Kris Kobach, who has, you know, a Javert-like interest in hunting down and hounding to their deaths illegal voters. And he's been able to find 9 of them in about 2 years of trying. And elections are rarely decided by 9 votes. It kind of makes you think if he can't find them, if he can't find more than 9, there really can't be very many more than 9. And I think maybe a thing worth also mentioning is, you know, a lot of states have, for example, a lot of dead people on the voting rolls, which is, I mean, for all I know, my mother, who passed in 2006, she may be on the voting rolls. That's not voter fraud unless somebody shows up claiming to be my mother and trying to vote, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, are the voter rolls as accurate as they should be? No. Does that mean that that's going to lead to mass voter fraud? No. There are already very strict penalties in place for illegally voting. You're going to face, in many states, a felony charge. You're going to face, in some states, up to 5 years in prison. In certain states, you'll never be able to vote again if you're convicted of this. So you're really trying to change one extra vote, and you're risking jail time and not being able to ever vote again. So the thing is it's not that voter fraud is impossible to commit. It's that the risks never translate to the reward. And the kind of fraud that we hear about most often is voter impersonation. So someone going in and, you know, saying they're Ari Berman and voting in my name. And that's incredibly difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Even in states that don't have strict voter ID laws, I mean, you still have to provide your address, you still have to provide your name, you still have to provide your signature. So, I mean, even if you were to impersonate me in New York where I live, you would still have to know where my polling place is. You'd have to know what my exact signature looks like. You have to know that I didn't vote before. You'd have to know that nobody knows who I am or what I look like when my neighbors work at the polls. I mean, so like, and then you'd only be changing one extra vote. So that's why I just think this is a very small problem, because it just doesn't make any sense why someone would do it.
Right. I just want to make two observations about ways in which some of these claims don't pass the smell test. Obviously, if 3 to 5 million people voted illegally, it should be possible very easily to produce 5,000 of them. That's not right. You know, that's a tiny. Well, there isn't. There are 5,000 people who voted illegally. Nobody has any list like that. And the other thing is, like, particularly Mr. Kobach, who we're going to get to a little bit more in just a second. You know, one of his fundamental arguments seems to be that he's very worried that illegal immigrants, people who are here illegally, are going to or are voting illegally. And I mean, once again, this is just intuitive. It's just the smell test. But generally, and I've known a few people who are here illegally, one of the things they don't want to do is call a lot of attention to themselves. They're not like interested in generating a lot of paperwork on their own behalf or showing up in public places where people might ask them for identification. I mean, these are all things that are complete anathema and the absolute reverse of what somebody who's here illegally wants to do. So the notion that that would be their major concern, as opposed to not getting caught, which is like a really big concern if you're here illegally. The notion of trying to vote would be something you'd want to do. I mean, it's just insane.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And that the last people that would vote illegally are people who are here illegally, because they are trying to stay out of the shadows. So when it does happen, when there are cases of illegal voting by either non-citizens or undocumented immigrants, usually because they're confused about how the political process works. They might have obtained a driver's license, for example. They might have been asked if they wanted to register to vote erroneously. So this is a very, very rare thing. And like I said, I mean, Kobach in Kansas is one of the only secretaries of state that's in the position to actually try to prove this, because he has prosecutorial power, and he's only found one instance of a non-citizen voting. So, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. There's no empirical evidence of it. I think what it is, it's a scare tactic. And I think it's a scare tactic that's both trying to combine anti-immigrant sentiment with voter suppression. So I think it's a very easy population to try to scapegoat. People are very afraid of the changing demographics of the country in certain places. And so a lot of the rhetoric that we hear about illegal immigration, which in my view is another thing that tends to be wildly overstated, now we're hearing in the electoral realm. So they're not just stealing our jobs, they're stealing our votes. And I think that kind of politics plays well with certain elements of the Republican base.
In Kansas, Mr. Kobach has also figured out, and it won't work everywhere, but I think it works pretty well in Kansas, a pretty good way of solidifying a power base, which is that Kansas is an overwhelmingly red state. So the people who are registered to vote right now, they're registered to vote, and they vote, as they say, Republican in pretty consistent numbers. And what he seems to have done, I'm judging some of this from your reporting, but some of it, I actually did spend some time on the Secretary of State's site today. It's like really hard to register to vote if you're a new person, whatever kind of new person you are. But the odds really favor the idea that a new person, a person newly trying to vote, might not be a Republican, might be a young person just able to vote. They skew a little bit more to the left, or a person of color. You know, some of the people who might be trying to register to vote for the first time are less demographically favorable to Mr. Kobach. And so he's just made it really hard, right? And not only do you have to have proof of citizenship, you have to be able to like upload it as a PDF and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, so what we've seen in Kansas is the state now requires anyone who registers after 2013 to show documentary proof of citizenship to register to vote, meaning you have to have a copy of your passport, your birth certificate, or your naturalization papers. Now, a certain percentage of Americans just don't have those documents at all. A much larger percentage of Americans don't carry those documents around with them when they go to register to vote or do anything else. I only carry my passport on me when I'm going abroad. So you can't use your driver's license in Kansas as proof of citizenship. So what happened is that 1 in 7 people have been blocked from registering in Kansas because of this proof of citizenship law. And that's a very, very high number of people. I mean, imagine if there's 7 people in line at a grocery store and 1 out of 7 of them isn't allowed to buy groceries. And you see the kind of effect that this would have. And if you look at the people, as you mentioned, who couldn't register, they're people who were overwhelmingly first-time registrants because it only applied to people who registered after 2013. That means they're more likely to be younger. They're less likely to be Republican voters. They're more likely to be Democratic or unaffiliated voters. They're also more likely to be younger people, people of color, people who are low income, who move more, who may not have these kind of documents readily available. So it's an example of how the electorate was basically frozen by putting one of these policies in place, which benefited the status quo in a state like Kansas and benefited the Republican Party.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happened here with this somewhat innocuous-sounding Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. They put out a request to all 50 states asking for all this voter data. It's first names, last names, middle initials, if available, addresses, dates of birth, political party, last 4 digits of Social Security number, if available, voter history, that's elections voted in from 2006 onward, active, inactive, status, cancel status. I could go on. There's like, you know, I am not all the way through listing all the things that they're asking for. And in a kind of remarkable wholesale rejection that cuts across party lines and geographical lines, 44 states have refused to fully cooperate. I mean, the Secretary of State or whatever the head voter person in Mississippi is told them to go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, I don't picture Mississippi as a place that has a robust American Civil Liberties Union chapter, which is supported by everybody. I mean, so what's up with this? Like, people are refusing to cooperate whom I would have guessed probably would have cooperated, as well as the people I would have guessed wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I, quite frankly, I was also surprised to see states like Mississippi and Louisiana and Arizona denounce this effort in such strong terms. I mean, I think what happened here is that Kris Kobach said he wanted all of this publicly available data, but in fact, a lot of it was not publicly available. It was very sensitive information, like Social Security numbers, like a criminal history, a military history, other things that people don't want shared with the federal government and particularly don't want shared with Donald Trump. And Kris Kobach himself has a very long history of misusing these kind of data, using government databases incorrectly to generate thousands of false cases of fraud. He was just sanctioned by a federal court last month for, in the court's words, deceptive conduct and lack of candor, which is really remarkable for a federal court to do this to a top election official. And so I think what happened was a few states started saying no. Other states started looking at it. It started becoming a political issue. People started, tweeting about it. People started writing about it. People started going on TV and denouncing it. Some states realized they were prohibited by law from handing over this data. Then it turned out that Kobach's home state of Kansas, he couldn't even provide Social Security numbers. So, I mean, the whole thing was just a complete disaster. Members of his own commission, members of Trump's own election commission said no. The Indiana Secretary of State from Mike Pence's home state, who's chair of the commission, said she wouldn't turn over this data. The Maine Secretary of State, who's also on the commission, said he wouldn't turn over this data. So, I mean, it looks like, number one, that Kobach either didn't realize what was publicly available or was trying to be deceptive in terms of getting all this information that was not publicly available and saying it was public. And then number two, he clearly didn't consult with his own commissioners on this because they were rejecting his request. So this was done in a very haphazard way. But to me, it was just alarming that he asked for this in the first place, because one thing that hasn't really gotten much coverage is the same day as this letter that Kobach sent, the Department of Justice also sent a letter. And they asked every state how they were maintaining their voting rolls under the National Voter Registration Act, which basically was a precursor to them saying to states, we're going to sue you if you don't start purging your voting rolls under the National Voter Registration Act. So I think one reason that Kobach wanted all this data was to try to assist with these larger voter purges, which could be very inaccurate, discriminatory, and alarming before an election.
I think another thing that happened here was, in addition to everything that you talked about, the voters didn't like it. At least that's what happened here in Connecticut. Our Secretary of State's initial response was something along the lines of, I hope I'm characterizing this fairly well, there's some stuff that is available to anybody, so we can't very well tell you you can't have it if anybody can have it. So you can have that stuff, but you can't have the other stuff that isn't available to anybody. And then voters were so upset about this, and she received so many communications, that she sort of revised it and went in the, you know, the Michael Corleone direction, the my offer to you is nothing. And so
it's
like
true. And you know, and it was really Connecticut that started this whole thing, because the way I heard of this letter was that Vanita Gupta, who is the former head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division under President Obama, tweeted this out, and she tweeted the letter that the Connecticut Secretary of State had received. So somehow she had gotten a hold of that letter, and then that really started this whole thing. And then we, you know, we realized this was had gone out to all 50 states. We realized that a lot of this was sensitive data. And then of course there's just the whole fact of, you know, you have the Trump administration, you have the president refusing to release his tax returns, but wanting all of this data on every single registered voter. You never have an example that I can find of the federal government asking for this information. You have the vice chair of the commission, who's just been sanctioned by a federal court for deceptive conduct, asking for it, who's been sued by the ACLU four times for voter suppression in Kansas, who's a very controversial figure, even among many Republicans. A lot of Republicans in Kansas can't stand Kris Kobach. So, I mean, this all kind of ended up being a perfect storm. And then President Trump tweeted about it. And he called his election integrity panel a voter fraud panel. And we're all saying, hey, I thought this was supposed to be about election integrity, that this was not a predetermined result. But it clearly seems like the fix was in from the very beginning. This was all about trying to exaggerate the prevalence of voter fraud and either to then put in place policies that suppress the vote. And that's why I think so many people were alarmed by it.
Well, I'm also, once again, just looking at our Secretary of State, Denise Merrill's reaction, or her second wave of reactions to this, which was essentially to file or at least issue a whole series of questions that she wants answered by the commission before she'll even begin to show a scintilla of cooperation. And some of the questions are things like, does the commission acknowledge that Russia attempted to affect the outcome of the 2016 election and that Russians attempted to hack into the elections systems? What is the commission's role in protecting our electoral infrastructure from sabotage of foreign nations or other types of malicious acts, et cetera? I mean, when you have a commission that has electoral integrity in its title, they're not allowed to only be interested in whether dead people are voting, you know, in Bridgeport or, you know, some of these other things, these, you know, mostly kind of anecdotal stories of voter fraud. I mean, we do have a pretty major challenge here in the form of cyber attacks.
Yeah.
And it's sort of odd that that's like nowhere in the acknowledged mission of this commission.
No, I mean, the commission's focused on all the wrong problems. First off, we just got out of an election that was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. I went to a bunch of different states, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, et cetera, where people had real problems voting. That's the first thing I would investigate. The second thing I would investigate is officials from the Department of Homeland Security, from the FBI, et cetera, have said that Russian hackers attempted to access election databases in 21 states and that they're going to do it again. To me, that is absolutely alarming, no matter what party you're for, the fact that our voter registration systems were penetrated, could be penetrated again, that our voting machines could be hacked if they were not already hacked. That's, to me, a code red emergency. That's the kind of thing you would want a Commission on Election Integrity to investigate. But in fact, this whole problem is being made worse. So the same day that Kobach sent this letter, the House Appropriations Committee, which doles out money for Congress, voted to eliminate the Election Assistance Commission, which is the only federal agency that helps states protect their voting machines. So that to me was a huge tell here, that at the same time we have this Commission on Election Integrity, we're actually defunding the agency that's supposed to prevent hacking from happening again. Not only that, Kobach asked all of these states to upload their voter files through a website that could have easily been hacked, that had no security protocols here. So under the guise of an election integrity, in fact, our election integrity is becoming much worse, and we're ignoring a lot of the real problems, whether it was voter suppression in 2016 or whether it's Russia hacking, that really does need more investigation and more explanation.
Well, Ari Berman, I have like 20 more minutes of questions for you, but we have to stop here. I do want to say to anyone listening that one thing that we haven't had time to go into, so I'm just going to give you guys homework, is Ari Berman's June 13th New York Times Magazine piece, "The Man Behind Trump's Voter Fraud Obsession." We haven't had time to really talk about Chris Kobach, what philosophies inform Chris Kobach's behavior, and why later down the road you might meet him as a candidate for governor or even for president one of these days. So read Ari's piece to find out about that. Ari Berman, thanks for being with us.
Colin, great to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. We're taking a break right now. We're going to come back. We're going to make you even more depressed. It's just one of those Mondays. This time it'll be about the environment.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
It's been pointed out to me by a bunch of smart alecks, you know, the kind of people who know what day it is. It's actually Wednesday. I just said it was Monday, but it sort of is Monday. It's Monday in a parallel universe where Monday is followed by Thursday and Friday. So I'm sticking to my claim that it's Monday. I mean, look, if the Trump administration can make up facts, why can't I? All right. So it's time to further depress you by talking about the EPA and the environment. They're here to do that. I mean, that's not her stated goal, to depress you, is Emily Adkins, staff writer at the New Republic, covering environmental politics and science. She wrote a piece for the New Republic this weekend about EPA plans to form a group to challenge climate science. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks so much. And, you know, it's you don't know whether it's my goal to depress people or not.
No, it's true. I can't look into your mind. So let's back up a little bit before we get to the thing about your piece. I think it's worth noting that although the Trump administration has never gotten even closely up to full staffing and has been pretty sluggish in pursuing some of its stated goals, the EPA, unfortunately, is an exception to this, right? Scott Pruitt has managed to at least begin the process of undoing, delaying, or otherwise blocking more than 30 environmental rules. I mean, there's an incredible rollback going on already. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that.
Sure, yeah. And I've been trying to point this out for a while. You know, even though the Russia scandal, the health care bill, things that aren't getting done, and, you know, general scandal and controversy, there's a lot going on that actually has policy consequence in the Environmental Protection Agency and with environmental policy in general. I wrote a piece maybe, I don't know, a month ago, where I just pointed out that almost Trump has moved forward on almost all of his campaign promises. He made
I think we're losing Emily just a little bit. You know what? I'm just going to let the producer come online and reset you. And maybe if you can have Emily move to a good phone spot. She's sort of cutting in and out here. While that's happening, I will just quickly tell you a little bit more about what we'll be talking about in this segment. So one of the things that Scott Pruitt is now doing is setting up kind of a way of arriving at a substitute for accepted scientific principles to justify some of the things that he's doing. And one of the reasons that I think he's needing to do this is that, I mean, according to Pew Research, 59% of Americans say stricter environmental laws and regulations are worth the cost, compared with roughly a third, 34%, who say that such regulations cost too many jobs and hurt the economy. And then this was done right at the end of last year, this survey. It gets a little bit more complicated when you look at it in terms of party affiliation and stuff like that. But, you know, I mean, one of the struggles that I would expect the Trump administration and the Pruitt administration at the EPA to face is the fact that most of what they're doing, I think, at the request of industry as opposed to at the request of the American public. The American public overwhelmingly skews the other way on this. Okay, we're going to go back to Emily and see how that connection is doing. Hi, Emily.
Hi, can you hear me?
Much better, a million times better, so much better.
Right.
So, talk a little bit more about sort of what Pruitt has managed to do so far.
Well, you mentioned that he's started the rollback delay or sort of stay of 30 different environmental initiatives. And what I was saying before when I cut out was that while we've been, you know, paying rightfully so a lot of attention to Trump's Russia ties and the health care bill, he's actually managed to accomplish almost all of his environmental campaign promises. The rollback of the Paris Climate Accord was a huge one. Almost everything that he's promised that he was going to do on the environment, he's done.
Right. In other words, that includes Obama's climate change regulations known as the Clean Power Plan.
Exactly. They're not fully done. You know, he started the process of rolling back the Clean Power Plan. He started the legal process of rolling back the Waters of the United States rule, which is a very large, sweeping clean water regulation, putting clean water protections on small ponds and streams and stuff like that. I could go through the list of all the environmental regulations that he's sort of stopped, but the gist is that he's stopped a lot of them.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and they're not totally stopped yet, but the process has started, and that is saying something.
So, I mean, there's that. There's this all this regulatory action, and as a number of experts have said, I mean, he's just sort of came in better organized than most of the people in the Bush administration and the Trump administration. I really am having a Monday here. But the other part of this is finding some way to put lipstick on the pig or somehow or other make this palatable to the public. The public, as I said, I mean, in poll after poll, the public, oddly enough, is in favor of clean air and clean water. They don't see environmental regulations, at least not overwhelmingly. They don't see environmental regulations as onerous or costing too much or adding too much to the cost of doing business. So he has to find some way of dealing with that, too. So move one, I guess, was to get rid of some of the scientific advisory people within the EPA who would have stuck up basically for regulations, right?
Yeah, he fired the entire the board of scientific counselors, which sort of helps guide the science that different parts of the agency prioritizes and uses. I think that part of that is because he understands, like you said, that he can't do all these things without becoming extremely unpopular. So public opinion is a big motivation, I think, for a lot of these future actions that you'll see. I wrote about the red team, blue team exercises. He started this panel within the EPA where he's going to have a red team, blue team, you know, climate change is caused by humans, climate change is not caused by humans. That will have pretty much no effect on any of his regulations or anything, you know, in the courts. But what it will have an effect is creating a spectacle or a smokescreen, really, to cover for, you know, his anti-climate change regulations.
Right. So this is, I mean, in a way, and this kind of leads into a show we're doing tomorrow, Western civilization is actually very attached to the notion of debate and argument as a way of getting to the truth. So he's kind of using that sentimental attachment we have to suggest that that would be a very good thing to have within the EPA, a series of sort of Socratic conversations about whether climate science is real. Although it's a little bit like, you know, maybe within, you know, a health agency having a series of Socratic conversations about whether tobacco use is really bad for your health. I mean, it's a settled question. So if you start having back and forths about it, you're essentially taking a brand new position.
And it's really hard because it's really easy for a side that wants to obfuscate the truth on climate science. It's really easy for them to win that rhetorical battle and say like, whoa, 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 like, let's just talk about this a little bit, you know? Why are the environmentalists why are they all saying that we that we shouldn't just have a reasoned debate. I mean, even Rick Perry went behind the White House communications podium last week and just said, you know, what are you guys so afraid of? Let's just have an intellectual conversation about this. And that sounds so nice, right? Obviously, I want to have an intellectual conversation. That's all I or any journalist really wants. But in order to have an intellectual conversation, you have to accept the premise that the overwhelming majority of the scientific community thinks that climate change is a problem caused by human emissions of carbon dioxide.
Right. And some of your reporting has also been also about how this kind of plays out in news media. You single out in particular a show called on CNBC called Squawk Box, where one of the hosts, Joe Kernan, seems to be, despite having kind of a science background, a very eager climate science denier, or at least somebody who's willing to enable and cosset guests who make kind of outlandish claims about carbon dioxide and its lack of a role in global warming. And, you know, I think another part of this psychologically, too, that makes it I mean, we want to believe that we're not in trouble. Like, given the choice between believing that we are in a tremendous state of danger and that some of the trends probably are going to be almost impossible to reverse, all we're really talking about here is mitigating a significant amount of damage and trying our best to keep the Earth at least habitable for future generations. Given the choice of believing that and believing that the whole thing is one big misunderstanding, I'd much rather believe the second thing. I mean, it's a much easier sell to people. Like, oh, no, you've been worried needlessly. And so in a way, the people backing science, Emily, have a more uphill climb.
Totally. I mean, I tell people this all the time is that I wish that the people who deny what the science says were correct. I really do. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it were up to me, I would like it that, you know, climate change was not human, even that climate change is not human caused and there is nothing that we could do. You know, if there's nothing we can do, you just accept the consequences. But what the science says is that it's, you know, a problem that we cause, which I think is even harder existentially to deal with. But yeah, I mean, I think humans have a really hard time dealing with long-term problems too. I have a hard time dealing with like the long-term problem of, like, you know, one day I'm going to have to replace the brake pads in my car, mm-hmm. you know, but I just let that sort of, I'm like, I'll deal with that one later. This is getting into like a big overarching thing, but yeah, there's a lot of rhetorical problems when, in the climate change argument, in the climate change policy space that are difficult to overcome to achieve any action on it.
Right. It's a thankless job telling people that they are in a tremendous amount of trouble from which it's going to be very difficult to get out.
You're going to die and it's your fault. Yeah, there you go. That's basically
nobody wants to be that guy. Emily Atkin, we love big overarching things here. It's public radio after all. Thanks so much for talking to us. You can read Emily Atkin's reporting in the New Republic. We're going to take a break. And speaking of the climate and the weather, we're going to talk to somebody who knows a lot about the weather, Jeff Fox.
Climate change. If it were real, it would get so hot planes couldn't take off. What's that? Arizona? They couldn't? Fake news! Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is not allowed to vote anywhere. Our intern is Carmen Baskoff. The part of Bill Curry was played by Catherine Harris. Tomorrow, a show about arguing. And now, back to Colin.
I suppose that's something, you know, we could have Chris Kobach do, is investigate Amanda Fish. Find out, where does Amanda Fish actually vote? All right, joining us now is a name recognizable to many people, provided your roots here in the state of Connecticut go back far enough, is Jeff Fox, meteorologist for WTNH Channel 8 News. And we should say he is returning as meteorologist to WTNH Channel 8 News after a protracted absence. We'll have him talk about exactly how and why he's doing that right now. Hi, Jeff. I think you're on Skype, right?
I am. So, hi, Colin.
Hi. So I was a big fan of your work when you were here in Connecticut. I know that David Letterman is your hero. He was a weatherman at one point. I often felt as though you were basically what David Letterman would have been if he'd continued to be in the business of delivering the weather. And so I think a lot of people have missed your work here. So you're back at TNH, but you're also, I know from knowing you, that you're a technology freak, and you're actually using an unusual kind of technology to do this. Explain what you're doing.
Yeah, well, actually, I am doing the weather on Channel 8 from my home in California. And as far as we know, Colin, I am the only anchor on a newscast in America, maybe the world, who works from home. So, you know, it was taking off-the-shelf stuff, but adapting it and deciding how to use it so it could accomplish this goal.
And so, I mean, obviously we can't get too in the weeds with this because we don't know all the words that you know for technology. But, I mean, basically what you've done is, I mean, a lot of what we see on a weather forecast anyway on television is stuff that looks different on our TV screens from what it looks like in the studio. There's sort of a lot of digital magic anyway. Maybe you can sort of say how you're essentially creating the illusion of being here with us.
Well, so we took my garage. I have a two-car garage, which is now a studio. And the back wall of the garage is painted green. There's a color that everybody seems to like the most from Home Depot, and we bought that and painted the wall. And so that's the chroma key wall, which is how most television stations show their weather maps. Everything that's green disappears. You try not to wear anything green, and then is replaced by the map. So, you know, for that, it's exactly the same as if I were in the studio in Connecticut, and I use the same maps which come to me from the studio in Connecticut. And as far as weather forecasting is concerned, the window as a forecasting device is vastly overrated.
Obviously the world is watching this. This is an experiment. It hasn't really ever been done before as far as anybody knows, as you say. And initially there have been, I think it's fair to say, a few glitches, right? You're
yes,
struggling
absolutely.
Through. Yes, absolutely. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm trying to do with this equipment. It was sort of designed to do this if you extend it to the farthest reaches, but I'm not sure anyone has. So as I go deeper and deeper with this thing, I find more and more things that they thought worked, but that actually don't. And it's a little bit frustrating and maybe scary to be standing there and not really knowing if when you hit the button, if something is going to happen. But thankfully, last night, 6, 10, and 11 were clean, and I'm hoping for the best. I literally sent 400 megabytes of files to the programmer who programs the control room equipment I have last night, so he could look at some of my problems.
All right. So you're already with megabytes.
Can I just say one thing,
sure.
Colin? Me being on Channel 8. Maybe the most surreal thing that has ever happened in my life. Of all the things that I never expected in a gazillion years, being on Channel 8 was one of them. And when I got a call, this was months ago, before Ann Nyberg did that wonderful piece. You know, most people have to die before someone does an obit on them. But it was a really beautiful story that Ann did. But before that, I had gotten a call from Rich Graziano, who's the general manager of Channel 8, and actually was my boss at Channel 61. And I was so freaked out by receiving that call that I told him, I can't talk to you now. I'll call you tomorrow. He must have thought that I was like a complete whack job, a complete idiot, because this was, I mean, seriously, the last possible thing I ever in a million years could have expected was anyone from Channel 8 calling me. Not because I'd done anything bad at Channel 8, just because, you know, they had made their decision, and decisions like this are usually stuck by.
So I think, but I don't want to run out of time before we get to this. So, I mean, the other news in your life, and you're kind of alluding to it, I think, with the Ann Nyberg piece is, I mean, you've had a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, pretty much one of the scariest diagnoses anybody can get. You've been through chemo. Tell us, first of all, how that's going, how you're feeling.
Well, you know, nobody says cured because pancreatic cancer is considered an incurable disease. But as far as we can tell, there's none in me right now. I had major surgery called a Whipple procedure, this 1935 operation that with a little more sophistication, they still do today. It's the only possible curative action you can take toward pancreatic cancer. Chemo and radiation only suppresses things for a while, doesn't get rid of them. Pancreatic cancer is probably the most virulent form of commonly seen cancer that you can get. And over 90% of those with pancreatic cancer die within 5 years, 50% within the first year.
You know, we talk a lot on this show and on this station about healthcare and who has insurance and who doesn't. I think this is of particular interest in your case. I mean, pancreatic cancer is a notoriously sneaky enemy. The symptoms are subtle, if they're symptoms at all. I mean, if you're not in regular communion with your doctor and not in a position to pursue questions, you might have.
I went out one night and had Chinese food and came home and ended up going to the bathroom, and without getting too terribly gross about this, was expelling from both ends at once. And I don't know how your bathroom is built, but mine is not built for that. So I went to the doctor the next day, and this was a gastric thing. And they took x-rays and an ultrasound, and they saw it right away. I was very, very lucky, Colin. There are very few people as lucky as I am to have survived this cancer, and I lost 35 pounds. How cool is that?
That would be a glass half full attitude towards this. I mean, the other thing worth mentioning is that, I mean, I think with these kinds of results, you've received very good treatment. This treatment isn't cheap. The Whipple isn't cheap. The drugs aren't cheap. I mean, you need insurance, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So, you know, I can say this on public radio because everyone else is. I'm old. I'm 66 years old. I'll be 67 later this month. I have Medicare. My cost for Whipple, for everything so far, has been about $1,500. And I'm telling you, Colin, I must be in the $300,000 or $400,000 range for my medical care. This is something that no one, and Helene and I had put together a nice nest egg. Mm-hmm. No one can afford this kind of thing. And who the heck knows that they're going to get pancreatic cancer? You know, this is why we have insurance. And I guess if I can speak editorially here for a second, like you could stop me, you know, we need to look in 2017 that healthcare for Americans really is a right. It's not 1786. We're not bringing out leeches. We're not, you know, bleeding people to get rid of their diseases. We understand much more about medicine, but it's expensive, and we all need the care. And it shouldn't just be wealthy people or those lucky enough to be old who get it. Without this, you know, I went to the doctor the first time knowing that these tests could be expensive just to get x-rays and stuff like that. But it was all covered for me. But if I didn't have Medicare, if I wasn't under, you know, government health insurance, I'm not sure that I would have gone to the doctor that first time. And that would have been signing my own, you know, death sentence.
Jeff, we've only got about 60 seconds left. And as a broadcast professional, you know what that means. But I just want to go back to the weather for just a quick second and say,
yeah.
This is something they're doing for the summer. I'm wondering, I mean, you're a popular guy in Connecticut. People may really like this. On the other hand, there's something about winter storms. You kind of want to know that Bob Maxson and Ryan Hanrahan are trudging through the same snow as you are. Do you think you could do something like this from California in the middle of a Connecticut winter?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing it for the last year and a half in Nebraska and did it for a while in Palm Springs. Of course, they don't have a whole lot of snow in Palm Springs. Because it's about, in the last 10 seconds I have, when I finished last night on Channel 8, I felt that it was 11:30 at night. Now it's 8:30 here, but I felt that it was 11:30 because while I'm working for Channel 8, in essence, I have to feel that I'm in Connecticut or it just doesn't work.
So you might be the first ever method meteorologist. You're like really kind of, you know, living this role right down to the time disparities and stuff like that. All right. Well, Jeff Fox, so good to hear your voice again. So good
to
know.
Thank you so much. And Colin, you've written some very nice things about me in the past, and I truly appreciate it. But thanks to everyone. And just one last thing. I owe my job to social media. If it wasn't for Facebook, I wouldn't be back on Channel 8. That's right. Absolutely 100% true. Goodbye.
I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg will be thrilled. We'll be back tomorrow with a show about arguing, how it is something that we count on as a way of getting at the truth, except we're less and less good at it. Maybe we need to get more Eastern. That's where my house away.
Kansas Secretary of State's office, how may I repress you?
Didn't you used to say, how may I help you?
We decided to stop pretending.